Hey, this is Grant Wilson from Taps and Ghost Hunters. Check out theatlanticparanormalsociety.com, and you guys are listening to Ghostly Talk.
Well, thank you.
That was so kind of you, Will.
That worked out very,
that
very
was, that
well.
That was very nice, and we didn't lose too much there. I think we come right in.
No, it
worked
perfectly. I think it was absolutely perfect. Do that again next show.
Yeah, do that. Do just like that. That was great.
This is Ghostly Talk, and I'm Doug.
I'm Scott L.
I'm Will.
And, you know, speaking of learning, because we're always learning on this show. We're still learning how to broadcast. We, you know, people think, oh, God, you need a big radio. No, we're still learning. We still try new things here and experiment here and there. And, you know, it's a fun thing for us. So, you know, mistakes happen. We embrace mistakes. That's how you learn more things, actually. You know, in the music you heard in the last segment was by a band called Dolph. Really cool. I thought it was really cool.
Definitely.
Not everybody jumped to the mics at one time there, okay?
No, you were doing so well.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, I'll just hold it on my own here. No, you know, these guys actually, Mike, in specifically speaking, you know, we have this independent music program we do for the show now where we promote the independent bands. We play their music on the show. Anybody who wants to submit their music, we work it right into our format. And this gentleman emails me and goes, hey, I play in a band called Dolph. You know, would you like to check our stuff out and play it on the show? So I'm like, yeah, I'll check it out. And, well, to be quite honest, these guys are right on my alley. This is exactly what I listen to. This is just blood-curdling, just power, right? So, of course, I'm like, this is great. And I'm going to play, like, every single thing they've ever done on the show, like, the whole way through and not even talk at all. So, you know, a couple weeks later, you know, there is a concept to this, and that's why we have Mike here this week to talk about this thing. Mike, you still there? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I think he's like,
yeah.
No, I've had enough of these guys.
I'm
time
hanging
to go.
Up, yeah.
Now,
just hanging out, waiting for my intro.
Yeah. Well, okay, Mike plays in a band called Dolph.
That's your intro. I hope you like that. No,
you spent a long time writing.
You're that minutes.
Yeah.
Your website is, of course, www.daathmusic.com. Let me spell that. daathmusic.com.
Yeah, that's where you can check the band out. Mike, you're the singer of Dolph, am I correct?
Yes, that is correct. Although we do have two vocalists.
Very
keyboard synth related.
Well, the music is really involved. I mean, I don't like, you know, I've played music for so many years, and I know people, the first thing you play in a band, so you know, the number one question you get is, hey, what do you sound like, man? And it's
right.
It drives you, it's like, no, we sound like Dolph. Right?
Right, we sound like Dolph. It's an expression of the music itself, you know?
And that's exactly where it is. I mean, this is heavy music, you know, I mean, that's a safe thing to say. But there is a concept that you guys have worked into this, which is why, this is what I love about music right here, is working these concepts into the music and making it a form of artistic expression. You guys have been working on, am I correct?
Oh, yeah, and we're heavily researched in Kabbalah, which, of course, is an ancient form of mysticism, first, you know, originating with the Babylonian era and then working its way down into Jewish and later Christian mystics and other, you know, similar religious following, but we are not a religious band. I want to make that distinction clear. We approach it from a psychological standpoint.
Okay.
So,
well, the number one thing I saw here, as far, you know, I got some notes here because we needed notes for this, because I'm like, okay, I used the information. I'm like, oh, I'm lost. I understood it, but it's like, wow, this is some pretty heavy stuff. This is some pretty deep stuff. So, you know, as far as the first line, though, you say the word, and I'm going to probably slaughter this, so Doug, you might want to, the first sentence there, can you read that? Because I'm going to destroy it, man.
Can I try this, Mike, or are you
going to? Oh, sure, go for it.
And try not to laugh. Put your phone on mute. I'm telling you, this is going to be very interesting.
Okay.
I'm just going to read the first sentence.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I can't do it. Well, okay.
I think I'll be it's that hard.
The word klipa?
Klipa.
Yeah, klipos or klipa, right?
Okay.
Which is a husk.
Means shell or husk. The klipos are accessed through the Styria of Dolph, the realm of the archdemon Kronzon, the demon of dispersion. That's how this email started.
Yeah. It's not a way to start your day, Mike.
No. Don't read that at 6 a.m.
So just to break in here for a minute, Sephira means jewel, and it basically is a spark of the God force that's within everything. And basically, in the tree, and as the tree was being created, there was a schism or a break or a rupture that occurred at the Dolph point, where the tree ruptured from the upper third to the lower seven, And so there's a disconnect between the divine world and the material world that we live in. And Das is an access way between those two worlds, or between the light side of the tree and the shade side of the tree. So it's not, you know, negative in the sense that, yeah, it can lead you to a dark side, but remember, it's also the path back from that side as well. So Doth is a place of reconciliation as well as learning.
Well, it sounds like Doth is the center point, if I'm correct. It's between the two veils.
Right, and it represents the balance between the two pillars. And it means knowledge, and it exists between Chokmah and Bina on the tree, which is wisdom and understanding. And so knowledge exists between wisdom and understanding.
Well, now you say that Doth is between the two pillars, though. And one
right.
side is wisdom, and the other side is understanding. Which side? Because you say there's the shade side of the tree, and then there. Or am I totally lost here already? Did I totally lose it?
Well, no. I mean, you're hitting the first two. You know, you have your Kether, which is the your divine emanation sparking from above, and then it splits off into Chokmah, the divine male force, and then Bina, the female force.
Okay.
And pretty much when Bina and Chokmah got together, there something didn't quite connect there, and there was a rupture causing a hole. And that hole is Doth. That's why Doth is sometimes referred to as the invisible or the non-existent sphere. It's not that it's non-existent. It's more like a black hole. It's more like a portal that opens you up to the Klipo or to the husk, the residue that was left over from this shattering.
Okay.
So what's really interesting is the Tree of Life represents the act of creation itself, but it also represents the mind and man. So you have the upper third of the tree, which represents our intellect, our understanding, our wisdom, things like this. And then the lower seven, which is a quite substantially larger portion, is related to our instincts and our drives and stuff of this nature. And what Doth is basically expressing is that there's a fundamental disconnect between the intellect and the instinct.
Are you
with me?
Doug's like sitting here going, again, he's frothing at the mouth again. It does make a lot of sense, but it's a lot. I mean, it's a brand new concept. It's not something I don't think any of us here sitting here have ever really heard.
Well,
of
I've run into Legends of the Tree of Life before, and as a matter of fact, I even purchased an artist's rendering of the Tree of Life. What's interesting is this particular artist's rendering. It was physically, on an island, as he saw in a dream. It was physically on an island, and it cast no reflection in the water beneath it, which was really interesting. But also, there's, it exists in the Garden of the Tree of Life, which is a photo or an artist's rendering that Bonnie had purchased. So the Tree of Life means a heck of a lot to this one artist. And he was, that was down in Cincinnati, Ohio, when I was down there with Bonnie last time. And so I'm familiar with the idea of it, but not the concept of it quite yet. I'm learning.
And the concept goes into, we've all heard of the fall from grace and, Adam fell from the tree, right? And the separation between the knowledge of good and evil, after they had eaten from the fruit. This is all allegories to Doth falling from this misconnection between the female and the male force in creation and causing a fall or a rupture. And symbolically in our mind, in our psychology, that represents that there's a schism between our instincts and our intellect. And the klipos is, or the, the shade side comes into play because our intellect can rationalize a lot of these lower instincts and stuff that we have in us. So
when you speak of lower instincts, are you referring to things, instinct itself, we have the intellect to rationalize these things. Basic lower instincts, obviously, and tell me if I'm wrong, because I probably am, basic lower instincts are hunger. That's a very primordial instinct.
It's get food.
Get food, right? Procreate. Okay,
right.
That's another basic instinct. Survival.
Oh, absolutely, breathe. And that's one thing I wanted to bring up, is not all of the klipot is bad. We need some of that shell or husk, because some of that's our autonomic breathing that takes care of itself and stuff. So not all of the klipot are bad. It just represents the separation between one emanation and another.
But as far as negative things go, it can represent other things that we would consider in society fairly negative, such as the capacity to be cruel, maybe?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And let me give you a good example of that. Mm-hmm. On the tree, there's these two points called Gibora and Gadula.
Okay.
And Gibora is strength or rigor. And we need to all have enough rigor in our life in order to stand up and say, damn it, this is what I believe. You can't sway me on the issue. Out of my way. But if you have too much of that, you become a tyrant. You become, you know, Adolf Hitler, you know, where that goes. And on the diametrically opposite side, you have Gadula, which is mercy. Now, if you have too much of that, you lose your free will because you give over to, yeah, you want to do this, Mike? You want to go here? Yeah. You want to jump off this cliff, Mike? Yeah.
You're pretty much a pushover, it sounds like. That's what you are.
Right. And what the klipot brings to light is one of these extremes without the balancing force of the other. And Doth represents the reconciliation between those extremes.
Okay, so it's more or less balance. We're talking about
absolutely.
Balance.
It's the yin and yang. It's the balance point. It's the reconciliation between force and form.
In this mechanism, in this, I don't know, mythology, I don't know what it is exactly, in theology, is there ever a concept of three things? I'm noticing balance, I'm noticing this and that, I'm noticing, you know, you always mention two things at a time. Is there ever a third in any of the stuff that you've studied?
Well, yeah, in the Tree of Life, there's the upper third part,
okay.
Which is what I was describing, the supernal three. And many religions, you hear the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Yeah.
And really, it's Mother, Father, Holy Ghost. But they tend to leave the Mother out of the equation. And that's a problem because a lot of the belief systems tend to emphasize on just the Mother or just the Father. It isn't a balanced force. And this is when you run into dangers with belief systems and controlling people, is you get people thinking that the female is, you know, you get Mary Magdalene reduced to a whore. Of course, we know that's a mistranslation.
Mm-hmm.
That never occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that answers. Did I answer anything?
Yeah.
You sound like us now. That's great.
Well, I was wondering about three versus two because it sounds like a lot of this ideology
it's based
duality,
on
duality, but then there's
right, but there is three. There's the positive, the negative, and the balance between the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, there would be. Okay.
Well, yeah, and that's right. And it also seems like there's an aspect of dualism too.
Oh, it's all about dualism. It's all about balancing the passive and the active force. And people tend to polarize towards one or the other. I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat. Or, you know, people want to belong and you know, live in a group. And doing path working, I've discovered some horrific things working with Doth. And I can reveal those things to a small degree if you'd like.
Well, I'll tell you what. First, let's get an overview.
Okay.
A huge overview, because I think we you know, jumped right into some of the very interesting stuff, but Tree of Life.
Right.
What is it?
The Tree of Life originally started as a Babylonian concept, but then worked its way down into Hebrew scholars. And basically what it is during the act of creation, the sephira or emanations were created. And the emanations were put in place in order to cause there to be a separation between each other, because before that point, we were all just one thing. So in order for the divine to know himself, he had to divide himself. And so he put these blocks or barriers or klipos or separations between one thing or another, and so in order for it to know itself.
So that was intentional.
It was an intentional, right? A lot of people think that the rupturing of the tree was something that was accidental, or no, this is all done in order to create an individual. So we are all the universe experiencing itself in the physical plane.
One fried.
Wow. What other... Okay, But and then before we get into the other stuff, I want to.
Poor Mike is getting grilled by Doug. I love this.
I know.
I'm
always
a ball here.
I always do that when I
well,
get
this
approached
is really
by.
This is really interesting stuff, though. It's a very interesting system.
When I get approached by a new topic,
yeah,
I just
exactly.
have to grasp it and shake it until I figure something out or something falls apart. And before we get into like more of that, I want to ask how it applies. We are ghost hunters, right?
Right.
Where do ghosts fit in?
Well, ghosts and spirits are also trapped under a husk. They're unresolved, and they're how a husk exists is that there is a bit of the divine stuck underneath it. If it didn't have that bit of divine spark, the husk would just fall away into outer darkness.
Okay.
And so there's this residual energy that retains itself in an encased form. Like you, with ghosts, you see certain ghosts repeating certain actions over and over again.
Right.
As a residual.
Replaying the event. That is their own husk. That is the own world that they created for themselves. And the lesson of Doth is to find yourself apart from things, objects, ideas, because a lot of what we think we are is what everybody else's wants, needs, and desires are. And that forms a husk. And if we don't separate ourselves, and so what you see on this earthly plane is trapped souls, literally under the klipoth of Malkuth or the earth.
Do we then create our own reality?
Yes, to a degree we do. We certainly have forces at play, but we do have free will in order to choose and decide.
Okay.
And what about reincarnation?
Reincarnation falls into play as well because you do not attain divinity until you've reached and conquered the Doth point or until you've overcome duality or in the concept of duality altogether. And it's a very difficult thing to obtain. Crowley, Aleister Crowley, wasn't able to do it and was defeated by the demon Coronazone, which is a demon of dispersion, which is a very scary place because once you reach to the level and your awareness of Doth, things become very disorientating. It's where perception and reflection are confused.
Well, that's what I mentioned a few minutes ago, though, and it sounds like that kind of like holds up. You have this screen on the left, let's just say. And I think what a lot of challenges us people, like just on this in this plane of existence we have, we say that a lot here, I think one of the biggest challenges we have on this plane is to have balance in your life, not to go too far to the right or not to go too far to the left, to be able to maintain this sense of balance.
Are you listening, Will? No. I'm just like, because you and I both were fairly guilty this weekend. There was no balance whatsoever.
Well, yeah. Mike, am I wrong on that? I mean, that's what it sounds like. You just said Aleister Crowley tried to master duality himself, and he lost, right?
He lost that battle, and it's documented that he lost that battle. He was never the same after, which, because he was never to resolve that duality in himself.
Mm-hmm.
And my personal challenge is to confront that duality and to overcome it. And that's why I say, when I catch myself, you know, just saying things like, why am I doing this? Oh, it's because my dad did this. Or why am I doing this? Oh, because my mom did it. It's not that I reflect it. The problem is most people are just reacting. They're just a reaction. They're not a reflection. Mm-hmm. If we stop and reflect, we can become divinity. But we don't. We react, and so we become everybody else's wants, needs, and desires.
Is there a way to lose that spark of divinity within you?
Yes, you can actually lose the spark and be cast into outer darkness.
Oh, man,
so
I'm in trouble.
There is a way of actually going too far in one extreme or another and losing your spark altogether.
Well, now it makes a lot of sense as far as the broad, the high level of this. Like I said a second ago, there is this challenge you have to master Doth, which is this balance we're talking about.
Right.
Just look at your human body. Mm-hmm. Your body is a husk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your consciousness floats in the husk of your body.
Mm-hmm.
So you need that husk. That husk is your life support system, and it gives you a reference point between one thing and another. And Doth represents an abyss, and generally, specifically, an abyss of knowledge. And I can give you an example of what an abyss of knowledge is.
Yeah, please.
When you define something, it gives you a good reference point what that thing is. You can put it a word next to another word, and it gives you a context of what it is,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But you've done something there. You've pigeonholed it. You've given it a stigma. So that word then has all these connotations and things that don't necessarily express the entirety of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You see the paradox I'm getting at?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You need to have the reference point in order to understand the context of one word as apart from another.
Mm-hmm.
But in and of itself, you've pigeonholed it and you've given it a connotation. You've made it a stigma. You've made it a stereotype, and you've gone away from the true understanding of it.
Well, that's the most fascinating idea here, too, is just that, is that our bodies, they are that reference point. You know how far you can push yourself, so to say.
Absolutely.
Your body's going to keep you in check. I mean, I know just getting out of bed some days, it's like, oh, God, my body's going, no, you don't want to do this, man. Why don't you just go back into bed? You know, well, taking aside, that's the truth, though. I mean, your body is this reference point. That's what anchors you to this earth. And like you said, the doth does float. And did I mess up my terms now? I'm still learning.
Well, you have a spark that's within the klepos.
Okay.
And basically our consciousness, in our earthly form, our consciousness would be that spark. And the husk would be our body.
Okay.
And you can look at it as a very gross thing, but I don't tend to look at it like that. I look at it as a protective outer shell.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah,
treat
absolutely.
Treat ourselves as a temple,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Go ahead, Mike.
That's one thing when you're working in these realms is you have to be very pure of you got to not do drugs, not drink, sleep and eat and exercise right, because when you enter into these upper realms of consciousness, things can become very stressful. Stress can lead to deterioration. So
that's consistent with lots of people that talk to this too. They say you need to care yourself if you're going to try to explore the outer realms consciously, because your body can't affect by that too. I'm getting from this. Think I'm on the right track, honestly. I suppose you have to reflect on it, then react, not just react itself, not just be straight reactionary. You have to think about what you're doing. Am I correct?
Correct. I mean, we're always going to act, but the idea is to first take it in, analyze it, contrast it, and weigh it, reflect, and then make an action. Our problem is that we simply initially do what comes to our, the first thing that comes in our mind. Ah, attack that country. Oh, do the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the thing, and that's what the number one question I think I asked Doug in a given week is, am I crazy? Am I the nuts? Am I the crazy one here, or is it just everything is completely insane around us? Are people nuts? Is it me? I'm always reflecting on myself, seeing that I'm the problem of a situation. So, hey, kudos to me. Good for me. I'm going to pat myself on the back now.
No, I think it's something in the water around here. People are just acting up. That's
people are just weird. Mike, unfortunately, we're out of time, though. We got to run. But you know what? Thank you so much for coming on.
Good thing, and I'm glad I could contribute something, and maybe I could have you back on.
We'd love to have you come back on again.
You have
for sure.
to come on, because I have about 15 questions.
Okay. We're just gonna grill
on how far the rabbit hole goes.
So, yeah. Thank you, Mike. Your website is www.dathmusic.com. Dathmusic.com. It's DAATH. music.com.
And we're going to play another one of your tunes here on this break, and this is a song called Ovum. This song just makes you want to, you know, aside from all the spiritual sides, this stuff just makes you want to lose your stuff. This song is just killer. And I have to say, before we go on break, Mike, Doth is a killer band, too. I mean, speaking from one musician to another, you guys are absolutely phenomenal, and I wish you guys the best of luck, too.
Oh, well, big things coming.
Good.
I can tell you that.
Good.
All right.
Get you guys get signed to Relapse or something. I want to see you guys on one of those big independent labels for sure.
All right.
Cool. Take
thank
it easy,
you, Mike.
Thanks a lot, Mike. We'll see you, man.
All right, thank you.
Have a good night.
Bye.
That was a head full.
I want to learn a lot more about that ideology. I think it's fascinating, and it does, because, I was grilling, right, at some point.
Well, yeah.
I was like, okay, reincarnation, okay, ghost, okay this, okay that.
Well, and that don't happen very often, but, you know, it was just one of the, you're right, it's one of those new subjects.
I did that because it was brand new, and I needed to,
you need to learn about it.
Find out where it fits in. And it does indeed fit in, and it is what I had thought mm-hmm. it would be, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
It's exciting to me. It's a great new topic. I can't wait to learn more about it.
Check out more of it. I know they have reference links at their website, dothmusic.com, for you to check out more information on this or just download some tunes, because the stuff's really cool. We're going to listen to some of their music right now after this.
Morales Lake. Yes, it is the GHOSTLYTALK.
From Melbourne, Australia. My website is www.wendyrule.com and you're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Scott L.
I'm Will.
Wow. This has been pretty intense so far.
And it's going to get...
I don't think it's going to slow down.
It's not going to slow down.
No.
It's going to keep going because, I mean, this is amazing. We had Mike from Doth on.
Doth, yeah.
And
we had Joel from SDJ Productions come on talking about his new show. that we're really excited about.
Don't forget, contest.
Yeah, we're going to put that up on the website tonight after the show. We'll make sure we get an announcement up for that so people know what's going on tomorrow.
SBJProductions.net. And now
we're proud. We're very proud.
I'm and very excited as
Yes.
We have Dr. Andrew Nichols from www.parapsychologylab.com.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Andrew Nichols is an internationally recognized parapsychologist and investigator of ghosts, hauntings, and other paranormal phenomena. He is a member of the Professional Parapsychological Association, founding president of the Florida Society for Parapsychological Research, and director of the American Institute of Parapsychology. He holds a doctorate in psychology and is currently professor of psychology and chairman of the Department of Allied Health and Behavioral Sciences at City College in Gainesville, Florida, where he teaches accredited courses in parapsychology and psychology. He is also adjunct professor in parapsychology at Santa Fe Community College. Wow.
A little busy, aren't we, Dr. Nichols?
Yeah, welcome to Ghostly Talk, Dr. Nichols.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
A lot of stuff is obvious. I mean,
here's what I have to say, okay? I'm throwing it out right now. All of these, these different institutions and associations that you're not only familiar with, you're also the president of and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've read about these over and over and over and over again, because you guys you get talked about in many books, magazines. I mean, all these are very highly regarded. So this is an honor to get to talk to you, Dr. Nichols. I'm absolutely flabbergasted and thank you very much. I'm hoping we really get into poltergeist tonight.
Well, that's what we're going to be talking about tonight, is poltergeist generally. I mean, this is, you know, just for one second, this is like, well, we haven't said this term in a very long time. This is what we referred to as classic ghostly talk, because we haven't really sat down with a particular subject when it comes to hauntings and stuff like that. A long time ago, we did a show on poltergeist itself, like back in 1823 or something, like way long time
ago. And I had
ago.
Just yeah. re-listened to that show.
Yeah, yeah.
And we didn't do too bad.
No, I think we're going to do better this time.
Well, now we have a lot of help.
Well, we have a lot of help this time. Now, Dr. Nichols, you were one of the people that worked on a world-famous poltergeist case that we've all read about numerous times, and that was called the Danny Poltergeist case.
That's true.
As far as the research now, you know, to get a high level, we can just start with that, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that may not be familiar with this case. What was going on with this? Well, first of all, maybe they classify it as a poltergeist, first of all, and, well, more or less, like, what was the stuff that was going on? I mean, there's, like, the high level. What was happening with this?
Well, the case really began in September of 1998, and I became involved in the case in February of 1999.
Mm-hmm.
The case began when a family in Savannah, Georgia, the Cobb family, purchased an antique bed for one of their twin boys, Jason Cobb, and put it in his room. And after he started sleeping in the bed, he began experiencing initially a sense of presence and a feeling of a cold breeze blowing on his neck, and then later there began the more classic poltergeist type activity with movement of objects. A picture frame would repeatedly fall down, and they tried various methods to try to get it to stand up, but it would continue to fall down. And then later on, bed clothing would be moved from one room to another. Objects would start to disappear and reappear in unusual places. Unusual sounds, a sense of a presence, and even seeing visual apparitions as well. And eventually they started leaving pieces of paper and pencil around, and the ghost allegedly started writing notes.
Mm-hmm.
These notes would appear. And the notes identified the spirit that was in the house as Danny, who had died in the 1800s and had died in this antique bed. And so that's basically at the point where I became involved with the case, and that's sort of the background of the case.
Mm-hmm. That's basically the point where I would be running out of the house screaming like a little girl, too, probably. if that happened here at our, you know, at the winery, geez, if I had left a piece of paper out and something, well, if I knew it wasn't Will, first of all. You know,
that's always the problem, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you have to worry
about
it.
Yeah, eliminating the mundane is quite a challenge sometimes.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that as far as just a high level on that, I mean, I think we're going to get into kind of how the poltergeist works, because, I mean, I'm very curious to see how it was classified as a poltergeist at the end of the investigation. Is there anything we can go into that on a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I think, first of all, it's very difficult. I think that the use of the term poltergeist is pretty arbitrary most of the time,
mm-hmm.
because I personally have not found any great distinction between haunting and poltergeist cases. Now,
okay.
These things really occur along a spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, you have sort of the classic poltergeist, which means that it's centered around a particular person rather than around a place. If that person moves, then the phenomena move with them. Tends to be much shorter in duration than a haunting, usually no more than several weeks, sometimes just a few days, sometimes several weeks or several months, very rarely over 6 months. And the phenomena themselves usually involve movement of objects and percussive sounds, like rapping sounds on the walls and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, in a very small percentage of cases, about 6% of the cases, you also have unusual influxes of water. Water will appear in pools or drip from the ceiling. It will actually sort of rain indoors. And on even a fewer percentage of the cases, about 2%, you have what are called incendiary poltergeists, where a spontaneous fires will break out in the house. But fortunately, those are pretty rare. So that's sort of the classic poltergeist that you find at one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you find the classic haunting.
Mm-hmm.
A classic haunting typically involves a place rather than a person. And
okay.
various people or families who visit or move into a particular location, usually a house, but it can also be a stretch of road or a patch of woods, but a particular localized area. And anyone who's sensitive enough to move into that area or visit that area will experience the phenomena. And haunting-type phenomena more typically involve visual ghosts or visual apparitions than poltergeist cases do. They also are much longer in duration. And again, the most important distinction is that they are place-centered rather than person-centered. So the person in a haunting, you can move out of the house.
Mm.
But in a poltergeist case, there's no point in moving because wherever the poltergeist agent or the epicenter person around whom these phenomena occur,
mm-hmm.
wherever they move, it goes with them. So those are sort of the opposite ends of the spectrum. Again, the haunting is also much longer in duration typically than the poltergeist. It can go on for decades or even centuries at times, although the average is about 10 years. Most hauntings do actually fade out after about 10 years. So those are the sort of the opposite ends of the spectrum. But the
yeah.
reality is that many of these cases include aspects of both haunting and poltergeist cases. So I really don't make a sharp distinction between them. I've seen classic poltergeist cases evolve into hauntings. I've seen hauntings evolve into poltergeist cases. And I've seen many cases where there were a mixture of both types of phenomena. So I don't really think that there's a sharp distinction between those two types of phenomena.
And well, I was just thinking the same thing because of the one of the things when anybody ever tries to define poltergeist is I throw the Bell Witch at them.
Well, that's
not
probably
not
like
physically, but I'm like, okay, the Bell Witch, what was it? You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the Bell Witch case, it would certainly be a stretch to include that under poltergeist, although it often is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, you know, and I think this is the problem we had a number of years ago when we tried to tackle the subject of poltergeist back when we were, you know, when this show was in its infancy, Dr. Nichols, was there are so, and this is still, the study of the paranormal as far as hauntings, you know, in specific right now, there's so many gray areas there. You can't really classify things. We try to. But it, like you said, you've seen cases where there's characteristics of both in most cases.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, it's fun. And we do have our little five. I think we used this when we originally talked about this stuff back in like 2002 or whatever. We have our five steps of a poltergeist. We'll talk about that a little bit more later.
What?
Well, go ahead, Doug.
What? How many poltergeist cases do you think crop up per year? Or I guess it's tougher to get the poltergeist word attached to your case than it is to get just haunting attached to your case.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm wondering is, how many do you think per year would crop up in the wild? Do you have any?
I really have no idea how many there might be in numeric terms. My feeling is that they are far more plentiful than is commonly believed. I believe that low-level psychokinetic activity or movement of objects, or RSPK as we use the term for poltergeists, I think is far more common than most people think it is. In fact, I think that typically what happens if you have only one or two incidents that are associated with a stressful environment or a psychologically stressful individual, I think that typically they will be explained away. The person will say, well, that was a strange thing to happen. Something will happen, an object will fly off a shelf or something. And it'll only be one or two cases, and we never hear about those, except that I hear about them a lot when I do lectures or classes. Mm-hmm. Of course, I have many people tell me, well, you know, I had a strange experience happen a few years ago, and then they go on to explain. So I think that low-level type poltergeist activity is probably very, very common, but since it tends to be isolated and short in duration, most of the time parapsychologists never become officially aware of it, and there's really no opportunity to investigate it, because even if we did become aware of it, it would probably be completely burned out by the time we got there. So I think that it's far more common than people think, but in terms of classic poltergeists that tend to extend a little bit longer than that, you're right. Typically, the cases are more often labeled as hauntings than they are as poltergeists. But as I said, I think that's kind of an arbitrary classification system. I don't really see that there's a lot of difference in the vast majority of cases. The true classic poltergeist cases, as I described as being on sort of the far end of the poltergeist spectrum, are really quite rare.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are obviously person-centered, obviously involve no visual ghosts, just movement of objects and percussive sounds, those are actually pretty rare. And the classic haunting that I described is actually pretty rare. The reality is that most cases fall somewhere in between.
Well, the thing
that's
is,
true.
It's interesting, too, I mean, because you mentioned there's these small, isolated incidents that most people really wouldn't pay much attention to. Now, when it comes to me, and this is where I think, you know, I don't know, I'm not a poltergeist detector by trade or anything like that, but I am afflicted with this thing that people refer to as OCD, which is obsessive compulsive disorder. And, I mean, if you come to my home, you'll see that everything has its place. Everything, and this is just how I do things when I clean a house or arrange things. Everything has its certain place. Now, I've noticed growing up that there's people that I know, like probably the two people sitting in front of me right now, that you know, they kind of go with it. And this is something we've talked about before. They kind of go with it. You know, if that TV controller falls on the floor for a half an hour, it's not a big deal, really. You know, it don't really bother me. It's just on the floor. Now, in my case, unfortunately, if the TV controller fell on the floor, if I didn't pick it up, I would start kind of freaking out a little bit. So the point is I have to have this order. So what in relation to this, like a low-level poltergeist type of activity where something may happen, right?
It would drive you insane.
Well, it would be something that I think I might notice a little bit more than
you
other
would.
People do, because I would notice that TV controller on the floor. My TV controllers do not sit on the floor in this home. They stay on a table. So if there was one on the floor, I would obviously try to find an explanation for it where, okay, maybe there was an earthquake. I don't know what happened. Something crazy happened. But I would notice that.
I think those low-level types of experiences are actually quite common, certainly if any indicator is the number of people who tell me about their experiences, I would say that they are. Of course, it's virtually impossible, as you mentioned earlier, it's virtually impossible to completely eliminate normal mundane explanations in these things. You know, people do tend to exaggerate what's happened to them. People do tend to distort memories of events that took place sometimes years in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take all of these things with a grain of salt. There's no question about that. But I do believe that RSPK events are probably a lot more common than we think they are, and it's only rarely that they erupt into a full-blown poltergeist case. But I do believe, and I also believe that they're contagious to some degree, which is kind of interesting. I've had many investigators of poltergeist cases report that they had low-level psychokinetic activity in their own homes after investigating a poltergeist case. It may only be one or two incidents or may last for a day or two. And I've had this happen myself on two occasions, which was odd.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing, too, and this is a question I have concerning these low-level poltergeists. And this is actual, from my childhood, experience I had. I don't know, I may have mentioned it on the show. It's maybe another one. I always tell people, I've never seen anything. Nothing's ever happened to me. I'm total skeptic. But I always remember these things that have happened to me in the past. For example, this situation. This fits right in with what we're talking about. I was very late one night. When I was way younger, I lived with my parents, and it was like around 2 a.m. in the morning, and I had on my bedstand, it was a bottle, oh, I'm sorry, like a tube of like, you know, hand cream, you know, just for your hands. Leave it alone. But anyways, so, you know, it was a tube of stuff I had sitting there. I put it there for some reason, whatever. And well, this particular night, I was, and this is what I'm, the question is, you guys are laughing at me, stop it, leave it alone. This night I was listening to some music, for example.
How
my question
old
is,
were you?
Don't, just shut up.
No,
just
I'm asking because poltergeist.
Well, no, I was around 16 or 17 years old. Okay. Between 15 and 17, I'll say. And what was happening is that you talk about this stressful environment where you might have this low-level activity. And I mean, we know this, too, before even going into this conversation, that the responsible parties are usually people in a lot of situations. Psychokinesis, right? Now, this particular night, I was listening to some pretty, you know, aggressive music, some pretty scary kind of like horror type music, right? And at that age, you're a little more impressionable. I mean, I'm old now, so nothing really affects me. And it was kind of some, the stuff did kind of lay a creepy environment for me. I was listening to stuff real late at night. Everybody's asleep in the house. It's pitch black outside. I'm all by myself. And what happened in a nutshell is I came back into the bedroom and I had a basket on the floor full of clothes. And I remember vividly watching this happen, and it could have fell. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, take that completely out. It could have fell. But what I saw was this tube just kind of go and slide off the bedstand into the basket of clothes. And it was something that really caught me off guard, to be honest with you. If it was something that just fell off there, I'd have been like, okay, whatever, fell off, put it back up on the table. But it really was something that it came off the table, and it kind of flew out. Like as if there was some force behind it pushing
it. Had to slide.
It had to be pushed a little bit to get that momentum. My question is, you know, obviously, may I have had a low-level poltergeist experience in that situation? I'm within the age, kind of like the height. Well, we know that there's this age thing with females, not males generally.
No, it's actually both. It's almost 50-50 now.
Oh, really?
It's between 11 and 20 years old. Yeah, when the early poltergeist research was done in the end of the 19th century, it was about 80% female. Mm-hmm. But in recent years, it's just about evened out. It's still slightly in favor of females, but it's almost 50-50.
Well, the thing with the situation is, in regards to the music, real quick, it was some music that I actually was kind of scared of. The album cover was kind of scary, and it kind of laid, like I said before, it kind of laid this creepy environment down where I was a little, like, you know, kind of irked out a little bit. So there was that element of stress that we were talking about before, too, where I was a bit scared.
But
maybe it was my mind. I don't know.
But if you ascribe that incident to, I mean, you know, obviously there was a circumstance.
Yeah, yeah.
The circumstance I'm just, was built up for that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ascribe it to yourself,
mm-hmm.
aren't you then saying, well, wait a minute, then there is this ability that goes awry within you?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't
and
know.
And within other people, too, because this evidently happens to other folks.
Oh, yeah.
So if people are moving all these things with latent PK abilities, right,
mm-hmm.
isn't that just a little bit dangerous?
Well, I think it certainly would be if we were able to bring it under conscious control.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been plenty of attempts to do that over the years. Many attempts have been made to try to control PK activity, and certainly attempts have been made in the laboratory to get RSPK agents from poltergeist cases to learn to actually modulate and control their abilities and focus them with very limited success. There is some mm-hmm. degree of success. They are able to develop those abilities to some degree, and I've known individuals like Martin Caden, the author, who's deceased now, who was able to develop a very minute level of PK ability that was demonstrable on demand.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think you're absolutely right. If we were able to learn to consciously manipulate those forces to the degree that the unconscious mind is able to do so, it's because obviously some of the phenomena in poltergeist cases are quite spectacular and dynamic.
Oh, yeah.
If we were able to do that, I think we'd be quite dangerous to ourselves and other people. So I think that there is a defense mechanism in the unconscious that prevents us from gaining a lot of conscious control over that. And that's not unusual in psychology. There are a number of unconscious forces that are recognized in mainstream psychology that are not permitted to develop in the conscious mind to any great degree. You know, that's why we have defense mechanisms, and these defense mechanisms protect our ego from damage from unconscious material. And certainly, this would be an unconscious force that would be only released under very unusual circumstances, usually involving stress or some type of trauma. And my belief is that those defense mechanisms basically glitch temporarily. There's a glitch in those defense mechanisms that permit these things to happen. And it doesn't take very long before the unconscious says, wait a minute, this shouldn't be happening. And so it clamps down the lid again, and the things stop. And then those types of forces are redirected into more normal types of displacement defense mechanisms, because that's really what the poltergeist is. It's a form of psychological displacement. In other words, just as an average teenager might become frustrated with their parents or frustrated with a boyfriend or girlfriend and might throw something across the room or kick the wall, hopefully not kick the dog, but that happens too occasionally. But that's called displacement, and they're redirecting powerful emotional energies to a safer target. Mm-hmm. Because the person that they're really upset with or angry with is not a safe target for whatever reason, either because they depend on the person or because they love the person, mm-hmm. or because it's not culturally acceptable to dislike or be angry at the person, such as your parent. But for whatever reason, they are displacing those emotions to safer targets. And that's a very common psychological defense mechanism that we all use virtually every day. The only difference is, in the case of the poltergeist, they have access temporarily to this source of energy that enables them to displace their powerful emotions into the environment, which gives them a sense of relief without any personal responsibility. So they don't feel the agent, the epicenter of the poltergeist, doesn't feel any personal responsibility because it's the ghost that's doing it. It's not them.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, they're able to relieve and release this or vent this unconscious tension or energy or stress.
And is this a thing that I know we've less than a minute to break, but is this something that everybody has? It's like, here's the problem with that. Maybe we should wait till after the break.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that...
What you have just said, Dr. Nichols, is just fascinating to me, because this whole idea of this defense mechanism, that is fascinating.
Yeah, it's the same
and
thing.
And it took someone like Dr. Nichols to come here and kind of put it in a way.
Well, I don't know why I never thought of it. I mean, I know that we build up walls, but
a defense mechanism.
I also know that, like, for example, you cannot act out your dreams while you're sleeping because of the sleep paralysis thing, right?
That's right, and that's mm-hmm. a good example of one of those inhibitory devices that prevents our bodies from hurting itself while we're in our dreams. If we didn't have that mechanism, we would act out our dreams every night.
Right.
That would be dangerous to ourselves and others. And so I believe the poltergeist has a similar inhibitory mechanism.
Oh, man.
Think of that. But yes, we got
so much stuff that I want to hit you with in the next half an hour, Dr. Nichols.
Me too.
No, there's some really interesting ideas with this, because let's just take a break.
Yeah,
I'm so excited now. I'm just jumping out of my socks.
As short a one as you can find.
As short a one you can find. We're out of here. We'll be back in a few minutes.
We'll be right back.